Good morning, you're in tune with What It Is on WNCW. I'm Joe Kendrick, joined by Fred Mills and Michael Plumides. Today we're talking about his new book, Kill the Music, the Chronicle of a College Radio Idealist Rock and Roll Rebellion in an Era of Intrusive Morality and Censorship, and a lot of regional music history here on 88.7.
Matter of fact, Kill the Music is about my experiences in college radio and the nightclub business in the era of the PMRC, and when they were scoffing at federal funding for the arts, Jesse Helms et al. Obviously we're here with Fred. Fred is really a big fan of Jesse Helms.
Absolutely. Yes, Jesse's my man.
A performance by Madonna or Prince back then, they were so racy and risque, they could be construed as in violation of a felony offense at the time, but obviously they never were.
Well, anyway. I think people have very short memories, too, because we take a lot for granted what we have now in a quote-unquote progressive society. But I remember being in Charlotte. I was working at the alternative weekly paper, Creative Loafing, back then when Mike's Club, the 4808 Club, opened up. And it was an interesting time because the Charlotte music scene, as it were, was actually flowering at the time. There was a number of clubs serving different genres. There were a lot of interesting local bands coming. I remember there were bands from Asheville that were coming down and playing Charlotte and drawing from the whole region, a lot of bands from the Columbia and everything.
Well, it was
coming up.
And we can touch on that for a second. I tried to recognize everybody from the DBs to 8 or 9 Feet, the Bad Checks, the Other Mothers. The Ugly Americans, all of these Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill bands, the Sex Police. Johnny Quest, and those bands. Johnny Quest was right on the brink of just exploding. I mean, you could go to any Johnny Quest show in the Carolinas at that period. But from the meager beginnings of Charlotte scene, but also, I mean, if you listen to all these power pop bands, the DBs, I mean, Peter Holsapple and those guys were the ones that that formatted that sound, even the Sponge Tones, formatted that sound for these pop bands here, 20 years later. These bands, that were so influential, their influence carries here 20 years later. I mean, the power pop trios and that sort of
thing. Well, let me ask you, as long as we're talking about that, you opened up the 4808 Club in 88, was that right?
I ran into a friend of mine, a good dear friend of mine, Bill. And Bill had said that his stepdad was opening this juke joint and pizza parlor over on Central Avenue, and he was interested in asking me to run the place because he knew I'd just graduated, I was back in town, whatever. And so I said, I kind of felt awkward about taking a job over his stepson. His stepson's asking me, so I said, "Will you be my right-hand man?" So we went and started, put this place together. And he wanted to call it Charlotte Amusement, for the initial Charlotte Amusement Music Service, CAMS. And I just thought that was kind of dainty. I didn't like the name CAMS, So I said, let's name it 4808 Central Avenue. And so that's how the 4808 name ended up sticking, But that's where from the meager beginnings, we did Widespread Panic there. I paid him $500.
I was there. It was their first Charlotte appearance. That was around the time of Space Wrangler, I believe.
Yeah, Space Wrangler. You know who else was there? Bill Deal, who represented Jim and Tammy. Jim Baker. Bill Deal was there. The infamous Charlotte attorney was there.
He's a Widespread fan.
And he went there because his daughter told him to come and see. Dad, you got to go see Widespread. They're great. But he supported music, interestingly. I would see him over a course of 2 years, occasionally pop up at shows, Bill Deal. So that's just kind of interesting.
Well, this was a point in time when there were a lot of interesting clubs around Charlotte. There was the Pterodactyl Club. There was the Milestone Club. There was... I think PB Scott's might have still been operation. They were gone by then?
No. We touch on that. There were a number of clubs in the way back when days, short-lived clubs, and two of them were the Viceroy Park. Mm-hmm. Were you there when Bow Wow Wow played? When it was Bow Wow Wow played, Joan Jett played there. It was in the Richway Shopping Center.
R.E.M. played there, too.
Did R.E.M. play
there? R.E.M. played.
Played the Viceroy Park.
Viceroy Park. Saw the Gun Club there.
Oh, wow.
So there was quite a string of clubs. Now, Mike's Club came around at a time, too, when there was not a lot of support for local bands. It was mostly national talent coming through.
Yeah,
and that was one of your club's hallmarks. And a lot of the locals came there because they could see their friends there. And you also let all ages in, if I remember correctly.
Well, it wasn't all at the first location. It wasn't all ages. We started doing the all ages when we moved uptown. The Central Avenue location. We did our last show with Sloppy Joe in the Random Rhythm Section probably in May of 1989, and that was probably the end of the month, whenever it was the 30th, I guess. And I had started doing shows with the guy Chris Bionovich, and Bionovich I had met through Art Burke, who in Rockefeller's in Columbia. And
I remember Rockefeller's.
Yeah, and Bionovich had booked a show with the Cro-Mags. The bill itself was funny. The Cro-Mags, Destruction, and Elvis Hitler. That's the bill.
Not a show for the faint of heart.
Yeah, I had 11 days to find some place to move the 4808 to. And that's where we did Soundgarden. That's where we did the Black Crows. We did Widespread Panic again. We did Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker of Cream. We did Eric Johnson. We did the Bad Brains, Corrosion of Conformity.
I remember being at a lot of these. I remember that Bruce and Baker show
was
packed, and they were doing, you know, all Cream hits.
It was like 1969 all over again. We did White Room, and they did Brave Ulysses.
Yeah,
and
Bruce broke out theme from Imaginary Western. Ginger Baker did a solo, like he should do, and it was. And,
you know what he said when Ginger Baker came in, because it was just an old, dank, dusty warehouse. And Ginger Baker walks in, and he's looking at the stage set up, and he goes, "Well, I'm going to bloody well get killed in here," is what he said, which I thought was kind of funny.
Well, if he'd been outside on the street late at night in Charlotte, it could have happened.
It was right in the middle of the Section 8 housing district called Earl Village, which was originally built as some kind of barracks for wayward soldiers coming back from World War II. And it just become slummy and terribly run, and there were shootings and stabbings nightly. I remember one time we were driving up. I was driving up 7th Street, and I was in my then girlfriend. She had a red Porsche, and I was driving through, and there were people on every street corner throwing bottles at the car. As I was going up to go and to promote one of the many shows right up the street. And another time, I was standing out in the. It was basically a compound during the day. We have the fence all the way around with a chain lock on the fence. And I'm just standing out there next to the fence, and this guy comes walking up the street and pulls a pistol out of his pants and just fires it down the road, just shoots it down towards Earl Village, sticks it back in his pants, keeps on walking like nothing ever happened. And it was at that point that I realized, if I don't arm myself,
that was sort of like you were on
notice at
that
point. Yeah. They're sending us a message. So it was no good, didn't want us there, I did do that Schoolie D show.
Now, I remember that. See, and just to put it in perspective, at this point, we're getting into probably late 89, early 90.
Early 90. It was probably around February of 90.
So this is, I believe Schoolie D came to Charlotte, the rap artist came to town in the wake of the Two Live Crew obscenity bust down in Florida.
No. The obscenity bust didn't happen till August or September of 1990. But the disc coming out... The disc had been out, and the disc said that it was obscene, and everybody was up in arms about it, et cetera. And it was the first arrest was not until I think there had been some busts at Two Live Crew shows or what have you, but the first I think they had shut down some shows. I think what had happened.
Well, yeah. There was war being waged against rap shows.
Yeah, Two Live Crew was probably the most visual or prolific, target. And then Cop Killer with Ice-T's Cop Killer came out the following year. Yeah, that was.
Yeah, and at the same time, concurrently, you had things like the Judas Priest trial, where they tried to claim that Judas Priest records caused these kids to commit suicide.
That was about 1989. That was 1989. It was Judas Priest and both Ozzy Osbourne, I think, were co-defendants. I think, but two teenagers that had shot themselves in the head, they went into a playground and smoked some dope and then shot themselves.
So, a perfect storm was basically building in America And then not necessarily right-wing forces. I mean, parents were very justifiably, in their minds,
but it was up in arms. Sides of the, I mean, yeah. Fritz Hollings, who was a Democrat, was right in there. Him and Jesse Hill.
Yeah, it was like it wasn't
you know,
just
Siamese twins.
Right, right.
You know, it was censorship in stereo.
So what Mike is a club owner, and being a club owner is probably not for the faint of heart either. His experience is running the club, and I was there in Charlotte the whole time, and covering a lot of this for the paper, and I wound up even covering some for Billboard, working as a stringer. It was almost like a microcosm, what Mike went through. It's like a microcosm of what was going on in America at large. I mean, it's not like the forces of censorship descended upon Charlotte. It's not quite that dramatic. But there were elements of that reached out and sort of infected what he was going through. And
well, there's been, you know, I guess people would say, why would I care about what happened in Charlotte, et cetera? And what we haven't touched on is Fred's and his assertion is absolutely correct. The what was going on in Charlotte was just a reflection of what was going on nationwide. And September 18th, 1990, I had a show scheduled with a band called Guar, which had a album released on Metal Blade Records called Scum Dogs of the Universe. And they were like Kiss, Alice Cooper, Conan the Barbarian, Rocky Horror Picture Show, and Monty Python and the Holy Grail all kind of rolled up into one.
That's a pretty good description of Guar. Yeah, lots of, you know, they're like mutant Vikings from Mars.
Yeah, with acts of ultra-violence and decapitations and, you know, blood and bodily fluids spewing all over the place.
Yeah.
But anyway, I had brought them to town one time earlier in March of 1990 at the previous location. That location was shut down for fire code violations after an L.A. gun show. And then we moved, and we had to jump through all these hoops, put in a wheelchair elevator, and we opened up the second location. And Fred had written in his music menu item in Creative Loafing.
You could just say... I penned an item in the Creative Loafing that kind of very vividly depicted what you might expect at a Guar show.
Okay.
That did include simulated acts of violence and sex.
Yeah, so unbeknownst to us, vice officers came in undercover. And the thing is, these two guys, I remember seeing these two guys, when they came in, they had mustaches. I don't know what it is about every policeman that I've ever seen. You know, he's got a mustache. They both had mustaches, and they came in, and I was looking at them, and I was going, you know, these guys, you know, they're just maybe they brought their stepkids or something. I don't know, you know. Because it wasn't – that wasn't – you know, when you did all-ages shows, that wasn't too absurd to think parents would bring their kids, because that would happen sometimes. In this particular instance, they were undercover police, vice squad police, and unbeknownst to us also, they brought in cameras and stuff, and – and they were photographing the entire show, and I didn't see them. I was so slammed. I mean, you know, door money and bar money, et cetera. I didn't even see a lot of the show that they were accused of violating.
I saw the show. Yeah,
yeah. I didn't see it. I did not see the. I probably would have had a stroke like my dad if I had seen the the thing. But that was an operation in conjunction with alcohol law enforcement. It was Vice Squad and alcohol law enforcement. And interestingly, I chose a location that was one block over from the James K. Polk building where the alcohol law enforcement office is. You know, so I was like, hey, come over here.
Yeah, okay. So the Guar show is very noteworthy. But everybody knows that Guar was forever banned from Charlotte.
No. They were actually their judge's name was Richard Boner. I'm not kidding. It's a true story. The judge's name is Richard Boner, and he banned Guar from North Carolina for a year. Now, I don't know if he could necessarily ban them from – in a state court, he could ban them from North Carolina
basically
for a year.
Basically terms of probation, you know.
Yeah, they banned from North Carolina for a year. They had to pay a fine. They pled guilty to harmful performance to minors, and banned from North Carolina for a year was the dictum. And David Brockie's response was that the Judge Boner handed down a pretty stiff decision.
Well, David Brockie was the lead singer for Guar.
Lead singer.
And I can, just to give some context here, I was there at that show that night, and I watched, you know, and it was what, if you knew about Guar, if you knew about punk rock and you knew about metal, you sort of understood what you were going to be getting, a theatrical show, very loud, with a lot of costuming and simulated acts on stage that, you know, if you are a kind of an uptight parent, yeah, you might think it's harmful to a minor, but to someone that knows about rock and roll, it was pretty much business as usual. But the powers that be took exception to that, and that led to, you know, like I said, Guar being their sentence partly was to stay away from North Carolina for a while. Now later, Guar actually
they played 2 dozen times since then.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and
so,
all over the state.
So it didn't. But the funny thing is, the aftermath was that there was this uproar around in and around Charlotte. On both sides of the thing, people saying, you know, how could we as a community have something like this going on under our noses? And other folks were standing outside and said, you know, this is the kind of rock and roll that's been going on for years. Why all of a sudden now are you coming down on it?
Well, but in I guess something that is kind of odd is they tried to be fair in the aftermath of the outburst from people about Guar. I mean, because there were people that said, "Listen, if you don't want to see it, don't go." There was that camp, and then there was, of course, we got to save our children from this. I mean, partially the reason why I had to do an all ages show was because a rival club owner was bidding to get the same show, and he couldn't do the show because he served hard liquor, and they wanted an all ages show. And I did all ages shows, and they said, "Listen, well, we'll let you have the show if you do an all ages show." And so I was a little bit sketchy about it, noting their performance, because I was on notice that the performance was as crazy it was. But I said yes. I agreed to their terms. Otherwise, I could. And that was with William Morris Agency. And I couldn't have gotten the show otherwise. But what I was saying is you had the people that were totally vehemently opposed to that sort of thing, that this is going to warp the children. And then you had the people, "Well, don't go. If you don't want your kid to go, tell your kid not to go. I mean, you should control your child." And so I think in an interest to be fair, they busted Spirit Square for a full frontal nude. Do you remember this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they busted. They raided a play in progress at Spirit Square that had a play, and the name escapes me of the play, but it was a full frontal nude scene.
So equal opportunity crackdown.
Basically.
Was that Angels in America?
It may have been.
Yeah.
It may have been Angels in America. But
yeah,
but
this was again a vestige of the Jesse Helms era. There was a right-wing reverend in that area that always launched these protests.
Joe Chambers.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. In Mike's book, he's got the beginning. He's got a great quote from Frank Zappa that's pertinent to all this. And I thought I'd read this from Frank Zappa. "Shrewdly, our legislators calculated that most people were too lazy to perform a real crime. So new laws had to be manufactured to make it possible for anyone to violate them at any time, day or night, which one of the reasons why music was eventually made illegal." And Frank, you know, rest your soul.
And all his wisdom.
Yeah, you know, the man was always a font of wisdom, and that never truer was that. I mean.
I mentioned something earlier, and this is just like a kind of like off, you know, in left field, why I felt the need to put that Zappa quote in is, it's such a great quote. It touches everything that the book is about. But B, Frank Zappa was a big influence on Henry Rollins and Black Flag, Greg Ginn and Henry Rollins. If you listen to Rollins' stuff, it is so Frank Zappa, it'd freak you out. You know, and if that was an influence on punk, then he needs to be in there, even though if it didn't necessarily fit the genres that we were hosting.
Well, I think one thing Zappa's touching on as well, which certainly is pertinent to Mike's story, is that going all the way back to the 50s, the authorities tried to find scapegoats for what's wrong with our kids. And time and time again, rock and roll is that easy scapegoat. It take different incarnations. It might have been these leather-jacketed Elvis Presley types in the 50s. You know, years later is these leather-jacketed punk rockers from England that spit and cursed. And it just, the cycle keeps repeating itself.
Well, did you see Bowling for Columbine?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Yeah. Something that Marilyn Manson says, you know, because they said that Marilyn Manson was the reason why these kids went berserk and went and shot all these other kids. And Marilyn Manson, he's an intelligent guy. I mean, you would think that he was some knucklehead. You
he's
know.
A little bit odd, but yeah, he's
odd,
a smart
but he's
guy.
An intelligent guy. And he said that they were trying to blame me for these kids. Listen, all I do is sing a couple of songs. You know, I mean, I would like to think that the president is more influential to people than I am. You know, what he said was what the media does is they get you to fear so you'll consume. You know, they say we got to, you know, the kids, they're listening to this music. You know, your kids are going to be just like these kids, cut to commercials, sell the mouthwash, sell the cars, go back, you know.
Well, there's a famous quote, some philosopher, and I can't remember who it was, said something to the effect of, society prepares the crime.
Of course.
For the criminal.
Exactly.
And I have to go back and do my homework and find it. But it's basically speaking to exactly what you're talking
about.
Well,
you know, and isn't it interesting how just in the past several months we found out the truth about the Columbine kids anyway, that they really were disturbed sociopaths. That,
yeah.
You know, this wasn't some kid that listened to a Marilyn Manson or a heavy metal record one morning and decided he was going to go shoot. You know, he was a really evil kid. And that says a lot about our society.
Well, and nobody even says anything about gun control. That's what I don't understand. Nobody ever – it's almost like it's a moot point to bring up any gun control advocacy. Because they just, you know, they just go, well, there's nothing we can do about guns, so we got to just blame it on everybody else. I mean, how easy it was for those kids to just to amass all of these weaponry, and then go and shoot people. And then nobody addresses that. They want to blame it on Marilyn Manson. You know what I'm saying? It's just ridiculous to me how our society values or ignores one thing, and then you know, demonizes another when it's just the old bait and switch. It's the smoke and mirrors kind of thing, you know.
Well, one thing it's interesting to me to reflect back on some of these incidents that are in Mike's book. Again, since I was there and seeing a lot of it unfold in front of me, and I was at many of the shows that he put on, and at many of the shows that were going on in and around Charlotte, is that, as I said before, people have kind of short memories, and the value of a book like this is to bring up some of these issues that we've been talking about, and also just to remind folks that you can't just take an art form or something, call it controversial, and say that this is bad and this is corrupting society. You know, you have to look a little deeper and look inward, find out what's going on the home front with you and your kids. And if they want to dress up like crazy punk rock kids and go out to clubs, there's nothing wrong with that. If they want to listen to, you know, loud, angry music, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, because if you raise them right, they're going to turn out okay ultimately anyway.
Yeah, that speaks to the theory that just let them get it out of their system. If you repress it enough, then you're really going to get something dangerous later on.
Yeah. Maybe that's my problem. I never could get it out of my system. I'm still listening to the angry, heavy
music. Why did you decide to write this book?
Okay, well, we can explore that. Well, first off, I started out a number of years ago just on MySpace, okay? You know, and MySpace is kind of, you know.
It's all Facebook now.
Yeah, it's all Facebook now. But that's what is it? Content over connectivity over content is what they're calling that. But anyway, I started out on MySpace. Writing these blogs about these old 4808 stories. And I started out with like five or six of these stories that I wrote on MySpace. I didn't prepare them in WordPerfect and then transfer them. I just wrote them on MySpace. The first story I wrote, I think, was called, it was originally called Gimme 10 Bucks Each, the Megadeth story. And the second blog that I wrote was about the Danzig show at the 4808 Club, which later appears in the book under Politics and the Devil Himself. And then the third one, I think the third one I wrote was Bad Brains and Corrosion of Conformity, and that one was aptly entitled Alvin, named after their...
That's a very lively chapter.
Yeah.
When the Bad Brains came to town. Yeah. I was at that show, too.
Yeah. The fourth one I wrote was Soundgarden, was my experience with Soundgarden. And then I think I wrote part of one based on the L.A. Guns show called Bullets and Hollywood Vampires. That's when we got shut down by the fire. And then I wrote the Guar one. And so I started out with these six or seven short stories that I wrote as blogs on MySpace and just kind of sat on them. And as the years it got closer to the 20th anniversary, and my Jack Russell, God bless him, Tiberius, he got killed. He was 11 years old, and he got loose in the yard chasing a rabbit and got hit by a car. And I was just so distraught and just unnerved with misery and grief that I started writing to get my mind off of it. And so I weaved together these stories. And first I wrote a screenplay. And then I used the screenplay as a template to write the book, and I figured to get it out by coming up on the 20th anniversary of the club's closing, and so this is the 19th year, and so the next year will be the 20th.
Well, one thing we've talked about on what it is a couple of times, Joe and Jeff and Carol and I, is how in the modern era, the whole notion of DIY, self-releasing your music, self-publishing, is a totally liberating thing. Anybody now can get their stuff out there. You're not beholden to a record label. In your case, you decide to go the self-publishing route. And
you and I have discussed that before, and do you remember the whole indie rock explosion?
Right.
And with SST, probably whether it was Touch and Go, and there was Rough Trade, and there was SST, and all these guys, Twin Tone, and then you had Mammoth, and you had Merge Records
up in Chapel Hill.
I think I say Sub Pop. You had all of these indie, and what was happening to the indie record labels is they were getting scooped up by these majors. These major labels were kind of swallowing up the indies, and Jay Ferris sold Mammoth Records.
Sold it to Hollywood Records.
Well, owned by Disney.
Yeah, yeah.
So in the same sense, and something that you said, you remember we were talking about that high art versus the lower rung of art. Novels, novellas, books, etc., fiction, nonfiction, are considered high art, and rock and roll is down here with the bottom feeders, But as far as releasing this book, I knew that it wasn't going to be a simple task. Getting a literary agent, sending out a bunch of packages, sending out manuscripts to literary agents first, okay. Secondly, once you acquire a literary agent, you're gonna have to sign a contract with them. Then they've got to market whatever it is that you have. Okay, then they're marketing, trying to get somebody to pick it up, etc. You might not ever get picked up. They might drop you. You got to find another. I just figured I'm just gonna bypass all of that and go ahead and get something done. Go ahead and get the material done, put it out there, and let the material work for me. Self-publishing the book through BookSurge out of Charleston, which is a subsidiary of Amazon.com.
Well, I noticed on the page where his book is listed on Amazon, there's a bunch of just really glowing reviews, a number of them from people like myself that were in the Charlotte region at the time, and they're reminiscing, say, yeah, this is exactly what it was like. And so it obviously has struck a chord with some of the readers, and that was another point I wanted to make when I was thinking about doing this segment, was that anybody listening to this, if they've got some quote-unquote old war stories, and if you have a way with words, get it down on paper and get it out there. You can do it yourself now. And
oh, absolutely. People a lot of times, and Fred and I, people think old school. They think that there's less of a value to something that is self-published. But to tell you the truth, in defense of that, I mean, I've run into that dealing with some of these, literary reviewers for newspapers and things like that, that they don't give the same credence to a self-published book as they would with somebody that's with Simon & Schuster or Random House or whomever. And so that I could say is probably I could see how people would be adversely affected by that and figure will throw their hands up and want to, you know, well, why would I do that, et cetera. But I was fortunate in A, I knew people from a number of years ago when I was in the music business, and B, you know, I had a promotions experience background, so I had an idea of how to handle it where other people wouldn't.
I think the point should be made too is folks think that just because a record comes out of a local band,
oh, right,
so they're not as cool as this national band, or they put self-released it, so it can't be as good as anything on Sony. Well, you know, to that, I mean, anybody listening to WNCW knows that some of the best music programming here is self-released and from the region, and the same applies to literature. It does not have to come out on Random House. It doesn't have to be, you know, on some big publisher. The idea is to make it available and then let the public speak for themselves. And
well, you know, decide. That's the freedom of the press.
Yeah.
But I have Ann Saunders here with me, who edited the book. I couldn't have done it without her. Luckily, she was a publisher of a magazine for 6 years, and I had that at my disposal. So it's not a cakewalk. It's not something that you can just throw together. You know what I'm saying? It's not just something that you're going to write on your home computer and then just hand it to somebody, and then it's going to be done. I mean, there is definitely a process. You know, you have to shoot cover art. You have to, you have to get all the, you know, format the book. But, yeah, I think that... instead of looking for a reason why I shouldn't do something, you should be thinking of why I should do it.
Absolutely.
And instead of you know, getting bogged down with these antiquitous ideals of how things should work, et cetera, technology, we're reinventing with technology how the marketplace accepts things and does things, et cetera. Matter of fact, this book was released in paperback, and now we're going to be released in the second edition is going to be out coming next month. It's going to be available. It's now available on Amazon.com in the first edition, but the second edition will be available next month, as well as the Kindle version.
Well, I'll throw this in too. Joe and Jeff and Carol and I recently taped a segment about summer reading, and this is a great book to take to the beach with you just for some good old voyeuristic sitting out in the sun, chilling, you know, chilling out kind of fun. You know, you can zip through it in, you know, a couple of afternoons, or you can just savor it one chapter at a time.
We're talking with Michael Plumides today on What It Is, about his new book, Kill the Music, and a little bit of regional history, a cautionary tale for everyone who wants to get into the club business here today on 88.7. What do you think? Email us, whatitis@wncw.org. I'm Joe Kendrick, joined by Fred Mills, Michael Plumides, and Ann Saunders. Until next time.
I want to thank you for having us.
Thank you.